My name is Anne Kenigsmark, and I'm an English teacher, a writer, and a former journalist. And now, I am your host for Cocktail Party Takeaways, a podcast for anyone with regrets, but not deep ones, about the books they slept through in high school. A little plea before I get started. I'd like to broaden my audience, and to do so, I need my loyal listeners to show their love. If you have not done so, please subscribe to the podcast, like it, and rate it on Apple and Spotify, and leave a review. I really appreciate your support. I heard from listeners that they are sometimes hesitant to fire up an episode because they don't want to spoil a book they have not read. So for this episode, I chose a book that literally everyone has read, unless you attended a school where it was banned. I am talking about J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, first published in 1951. Catcher began getting booted from community schools and libraries around 1960, primarily for its many swear words, sexual references, and all-around, quote, vulgarity. Lesser but persistent reasons Team Book Ban comes up with include that it's immoral, violent, and defamatory to God. I like that last one. Imagine God caring if we defame him. But I really laugh when I read that it has been banned for being, quote, anti-white. I mean, what? As the kids say, I can't even with book banning in general. Talk about vulgar and immoral. I like the meme going around on social media that challenges us to name a time in history when the good guys banned books, right? Right. Choose what you read. Even choose what your kids read. Hell, I read Judy Blume's Forever, hidden inside another book. So clearly my mother frowned upon its sexual explicitness. Did I find it anyway in my middle school library? Yes, I did. And a nicer girl would have left it there, knowing her mother disapproved. And that's how it all works, right? My mom's rules, my rebellion. My mom wouldn't have cared if I read books about witches or communists or death. But your mom might have. And if all those moms are allowed to get together and choose which books will be in the library, we'll be left with a bunch of phony junk no one wants to read.
Coming through the rye, fair buddy, coming through the rye. She draggled to her petticoaty, coming through the rye. Jenny's a wheat pear buddy, Jenny seldom the rye. She draggled to her petticoaty, coming through the rye.
That's your first takeaway of the episode. The title of the novel comes from an 18th century poem by Robert Burns, often set to music as a Scottish ditty. We will return to the song and its significance later. I remember vividly the first time I read Catcher. Okay, confession time. I should really say the first time I was assigned to read Catcher. It was assigned as summer reading before eighth grade at Grace Church School in New York. I didn't read it. And then I had to fake a book report, so I looked at the first page and said the book featured a character named, David Copperfield. Because the actual main character, Holden Caulfield, mentions the Charles Dickens character in a derisive way in the first sentence. I can still see, and I am cringing when I do, my teacher's red exclamation points in the margin. I don't recall what I got on that faked summer reading report. But sometimes I think about me, the avid reader, writer, and English teacher, not reading one of the most iconic school books of all time. And it gives me a shred of empathy when I get a faked-up summer reading essay from one of my students. Who knows why I didn't read Catcher that summer. What is weirdest about it is how many times since that I have read it. When I picked it up again later in high school, I vowed to read it every decade of my life, and I have, and then some. So J.D. Salinger, weird, hermit, only wrote this one great novel, and then a bunch of short stories, which are wonderful and weird. He was probably a sexual bad guy, but I'm going to leave that alone. you can for sure find a strong thread of interest in predatory behaviors in his stories. He seemed preoccupied with the innocence of childhood and the ache of losing it. That nostalgic yearning twists itself into something perverty, as Holden would say, on more than one occasion in Salinger's work. I did learn some cool things from Wikipedia. Salinger worked for a time as a cruise director, and he dated Eugene O'Neill's daughter, Una, the one who later married Charlie Chaplin, which is something you only know if you did the New York Times crossword puzzle last century. God, I'm old. Salinger also had a lot of out there spiritual beliefs, and he was traumatized in World War II. So let's get to it. This novel is very scene-driven, meaning almost everything happens as Holden moves through time and space. There's not a lot of existential navel-gazing or wondering about the world or giving long summaries. Salinger is a master of showing, not telling. He also lets symbols carry a lot of water, so pay attention to those. The novel opens with the narrator speaking directly to you, kind of like Nick in The Great Gatsby. But whereas Nick will come to tell us about a summer, Holden will tell us only about a few days, long days. There are times when I am like, what the hell time is it now? This is the longest night since that guy gets lost in Soho in the 1980s movie After Hours. You get a sense Holden is telling his story from a mental health facility of some kind, but the action quickly moves back in time to his last day at Pensy Prep, the fancy boarding school from which he has been expelled. Holden claims that he is a terrific liar, that he smokes a lot, and that he's illiterate. Some of these things are true, and some are not. Holden is not always the greatest reporter when it comes to himself. That is why he is known as an unreliable narrator. That doesn't mean he is telling lies, but just that this is very much a story told from his side of the street. Someone else might tell a completely different story. Holden has been kicked out for flunking four of his subjects. On top of that, he is the manager of the fencing team, and while in New York for a meet, he left all the foils and other equipment on the goddamn subway. So this guy is a professional at shooting himself in the foot. On the first page, Holden introduces the oldest of his three siblings, DB, who is a successful Hollywood writer, which chafes Holden because he thinks he is wasting his talent. We quickly learn that Holden has a lot of dislikes. Put more bluntly, he hates nearly everything, especially anything, quote, phony. That includes movies, the ads for his school featuring horseback riding. I never even once saw a horse anywhere near the place, he says. Any expressions of school spirit, and the headmaster, a phony slob. It was my pleasure to teach Catcher just once, but it was then that I discovered another controversy surrounding this book. Once you muscle your way past the book banning Moms for Liberty or whatever they are called, more trouble awaits. Enter the haters. A healthy number of students reading Salinger's masterpiece today react with utter disdain at the very mention of Holden Caulfield. Spoiled, they say. Whiny. Weird. Crazy. He's a brat. He wants everything to go his way, a kid told me. Today's kids, at least the privileged ones that I teach, have been taught to be grateful, to be hashtag blessed, to be happy. When I grew up in the 1980s, happy equaled dorky. It was a teenager's God-given right and duty to complain about literally everything. I attended a private all-girls school on Manhattan's Upper East Side where the number one rule was everything is lame. If you acted excited about any school-sponsored, adult-organized anything, you were the biggest dweeb on God's earth. One year, the cool girls didn't want to participate in field day, so we claimed our team was the Soviet Union and we were boycotting the games. We literally stood around Sheep Meadow in Central Park in our tree torns, picking our nails and flipping our hair and refusing to play a single game. Another year, the school had the nerve to take us into the woods. There's a picture in the yearbook of us standing like prisoners of war in a sad, miserable, scowling line. It wasn't even cool to like lunch. Every day, I would pass up the delicious-smelling fried chicken and put a plain bagel on my tray. I did not shake this early indoctrination until well into adulthood. At one of my first jobs, a coworker dubbed me the Queen of Disdain. Ouch. Recently, I did discover that not all of today's kids have drunk the contentment Kool-Aid. In addition to teaching English Lit at my private school, I also teach the yearbook class. For reasons unknown to me, the staff is all girls, which means they feel a little freer to say whatever they want. Last year, there were some seniors in the class who reminded me, not a little, of me and my high school friends. These girls were professional haters. I hate this teacher. I hate that boy. I hate math. I hate French. I hate exams. I hate soccer practice. I hate it when they have wings for lunch. I began to joke that we should put up a tracker like OSHA has on factory floors that counts days since the last accident. Hours would track minutes gone by without someone saying they hate something. We usually made it about 4 minutes into class. One time I was looking at a page of senior portraits and noticed a particularly lovely young woman. I was sitting next to a senior named Caroline, and I said, "Wow, she's beautiful." She shrugged. "You hate her, don't you?" She sighed and said, "Yeah." I knew we had scraped the bottom of the hate bucket when I was helping Caroline place baby pictures on a yearbook page, and she said quietly, "I hate babies." And look, Holden is whining, but they all whine, even if they do it more cheerfully these days. And this kid is thinking and feeling a lot. On the first pages, he is standing alone on a hill overlooking campus, away from the cheers of the football game and all the normal happy kids swirling below. And he is trying to figure out how to say goodbye to this place and this era of his life. This is the third or fourth school he's been kicked out of. He is hurting and lost, but he never says so. That's Salinger's magic. You can just feel it. The first real scene occurs when Holden goes to see a teacher, old Mr. Spencer, to say goodbye. Holden clearly doesn't like old people and makes a lot of funny jokes about poor old Spencer and his wife. "They got a bang out of things in a half-assed way," he says. What he is hoping from this visit is unclear, but what he gets makes him regret coming at all. "What's the matter with you, boy?" Spencer says to him. He then drags him through the humiliating exercise of reminding him how poorly he did in his class, how little effort he put forth. "Do you blame me for flunking you, boy?" Holden's mind wanders, and he begins to worry about the ducks in Central Park. What happens to them when the lagoon freezes over? Does a zoo or something come and take them somewhere? Or do they fly away on their own? Park those musings in the parking lot for later. He congratulates himself for being able to talk to Spencer and think about the ducks at the same time. "It's funny," he says. "You don't have to think too hard when you talk to a teacher." Well, that explains a lot. The teacher just keeps on with, "One day you will think about your future, but by then it will be too late, blah, blah, blah." Why do we adults always do this? Does it ever work? In Chapter 3, we learn about a peculiar hat Holden has bought in New York. It's a red hunting hat with a very long peak and ear flaps that can be worn tied up or down over your ears. Think Elmer Fudd. "I swung the old peak way around to the back. Very corny, I'll admit. But I liked it that way," he says. "I looked good in it that way." Let's think about what that hat might mean as we proceed. Next comes a scene or a series of scenes in the dorm with Holden's suite mates, Ackley and Stradlatter. When Ackley sees Holden's new hat, he says, "That's a deer shooting hat," to which Holden responds, "Like hell it is. This is a people shooting hat. I shoot people in this hat." This is the first of several disturbingly violent comments Holden makes. Some people get all jazzed up that this is the line that caught Mark David Chapman's eye, the guy who killed John Lennon. Chapman claimed to be obsessed with the novel. I'd say assuming this novel drove him to kill Lennon is a bit of a stretch based on Holden's essentially gentle nature. Stradlatter now. "This guy is a complete and total douchebag, pardon my French. After many years of teaching, I recognize this asshat. His crimes? He is popular and shallow." I'm kidding, those are not crimes. But he asks Holden to write an essay for him, a personal essay no less, about anything as long as it's, quote, descriptive as hell. Holden reluctantly agrees and writes about his younger brother's baseball mitt. "My brother Allie had this left-hander's fielder's mitt. He was left-handed. The thing that was descriptive about it, though, was that he had poems written all over the fingers and the pocket and everywhere, in green ink. He's dead now. He got leukemia and died when we were up in Maine on July 18th, 1946. You'd have liked him. In the narration, Holden goes on to detail his brother's many virtues, and without saying how hard it was when he died, he demonstrates it exquisitely. Holden was 13, and that night he broke all of the windows in the family garage. As a result, he could no longer make a fist with one hand. Stradlider asks him to write the essay because he is going on a date with Jane Gallagher, whom Holden knows quite well. As a matter of fact, it becomes pretty clear he has a crush on her, and asks Stradlider if he knows all these touching details about her, like how she plays checkers in a sweet and funny way, and how her parents are divorced. Stradlider clearly cares about exactly none of this. Stradlider is one of those guys who has what Holden calls a technique. He's witnessed it in the past. Quote, he'd start snowing his date in this very quiet, sincere voice. His date kept saying, no, please, please don't, please. But Stradlider kept snowing her in this Abraham Lincoln sincere voice, and finally there'd be this terrific silence in the back of the car. And that's when Stradlider would give her what Holden calls the time. He is completely unhinged by the thought of him doing this to Jane, whom he genuinely likes, but whom he also sees as some representation of purity. When Stradlider returns from his date and says that all they did was sit in the car, but kind of smirks when he says it, Holden hits him, or tries to. Stradlider hits him back and then some, and Holden is flat on his back with blood all over his face, still calling Stradlider a moron and a dirty, stupid son of a bitch. Afterward, Holden says he felt so lonesome all of a sudden, I almost wished I was dead. Oh, and by the way, Stradlider is pissed about the essay. This is about a goddamn baseball glove, he says. I told ya, it had to be about a goddamn room or a house or something. You don't do one damn thing the way you're supposed to. So Holden walks over, takes the essay, and rips it to shreds. Attaboy, Holden. This all precipitates Holden's late-night decision to leave Pensy right away, not waiting the 3 days until school lets out for Christmas break. He will sneak into New York and not tell his parents, instead staying in a hotel. And so begins our hero's journey. My absolute favorite line in the entire book appears on page 59 when Holden puts on his red hunting hat, turns the peak around to the back the way he likes it, and screams at the top of his lungs to the school, "Sleep tight, you morons!" I mean, how can you not love this kid? For me, the train scene is the funniest in the whole little novel. Holden gets on and sits by a woman who notices the Pensy Prep sticker on his bag and strikes up a conversation. "Perhaps you know my son, Ernest Morrow? He goes to Pensy," she says. Holden says he does, and then thinks, her son was doubtless the biggest bastard that ever went to Pensy. She asks Holden for his name, and he says, Rudolf Schmidt. That's actually the janitor at Pensy. He then tells her a pack of elaborate lies about her son, offers her a cigarette, and even offers to buy her a cocktail. And he claims he is headed home to have an operation to remove a, quote, tiny little tumor on the brain. In New York, Holden catches a cab and notices right away the driver is sort of a wise guy. Holden doesn't want to start an argument about directions, so instead he asks, "You know those ducks in that lagoon right at Central Park South? By any chance, do you happen to know where they go, the ducks, when it gets all frozen over?" The cabbie is having none of it. He turns to Holden and says, "What are you trying to do, bud? Kid me?" Later, he gets in another cab and asks the same question. "How the hell should I know a stupid thing like that?" the guy says. Holden drops it, but the cabbie doesn't. "The fish don't go no place. They stay right where they are, the fish, right in the goddamn lake. It's tougher for the fish, the winter and all, than it is for the ducks. For Christ's sake, use your head. They live right in the goddamn ice. It's their nature. They get frozen right in one position for the whole winter. I'm not completely sure what this duck thing is all about, but let me tell you what I do know. That cab driver. As I believe I have said, I moved with my family to New York in 1976 when I was 9 years old. So I grew up hailing cabs and interacting with all kinds of cab drivers. I got into fights. I got swindled. Sometimes I got to practice my French or my Spanish. And more than once, I got some great advice. But my favorite taxi tale unfolded when I was 22 years old and in grad school at New York University. I had a boyfriend who lived in Chelsea, and on the day he broke my heart, I left his building weeping and went out to catch a cab on 7th Avenue. "To Washington Square Village," I said to the man's bulky back and barrel neck. "Do you know where that is?" Now, I only ask that because it's kind of a weird address, not a street or an avenue. It's an NYU building, and I was going to give him some cross streets if he was unfamiliar with it. Needless to say, I had done this many times before. Well, this guy's neck turned red. He glared at me in the rear view and then turned his torso around so I could appreciate the full effect of his outraged mug. "Of course I know where it is," he bellowed. "I'm not one of those new drivers from Pakistan or whatever." "Okay," I said. I may have rolled my eyes as I turned toward the window and into my hurting self. A couple of blocks later, the guy looked at me again in the rearview mirror. "Look," he said, "I can see you are very upset about this." He was not sympathizing or peacemaking. He was spoiling for a fight. I can't recall what he said next, but it was for sure a further defense of his peerless familiarity with the city streets. Finally, I said, "I know this may come as a shock, but you are not upsetting me. I actually have a life outside of this cab." Well, that was it. The guy veered across several lanes of traffic and stopped sort of diagonally to a curb and screamed, "Get out of my cab!" At least I got a laugh out of an otherwise miserable afternoon. I walked the rest of the way to my dorm. What follows in Catcher is about 100 pages of anti-heroic misadventures. Why do I say anti-heroic? Because Holden is the classic anti-hero. Now, an anti-hero may not be what you think it is. It's not a villain. In literature, an anti-hero is a protagonist who is walking through the steps of a hero journey, but he is not equipped with any Odysseus-esque heroic qualities. He is just a regular Joe, maybe even a subpar Joe, bumbling his way along. But because he keeps on bumbling and not giving in, we call him a hero. Holden vacillates between feats of derring do and total cowardly inaction. He thinks about calling up Jane, the girl who plays checkers in a special way, and whom he fears Stradladder gave the time to, but he keeps saying, "I wasn't in the mood." If you're not in the mood, you can't do that stuff right. I wonder if J.D. Salinger had T.S. Eliot's old J. Alfred Prufrock in mind when he created Holden. Go back and listen to episode 11 of Cocktail Party Takeaways and tell me what you think. And I ask you, dead white male writers, what's with all the initial names? Holden doesn't have the guts to call up a girl he actually knows quite well, but he does have the courage to go to bars, flirt with women, take up the elevator guy on his offer of a girl for the night, and fight with said elevator guy about the price they agreed upon. He gets his nose bloodied again in that altercation. What struck me most on my most recent reading of Catcher was how depressed Holden is. I think I saw him before as a malcontent having a bad few days. But he speaks often of not wanting to live, of wanting to die. He talks to his dead brother, Allie, searching for answers. He wants to believe in God and seek solace in the Bible, but sees nothing but phonies here, there, and everywhere. At one point during his meanderings, Holden sees a family leaving church. It's a father, a mother, and a child of about 6, and they look, Holden says, sort of poor. Have I mentioned what a terrific snob Holden is? He doesn't mean to be, but his class snobism just wafts off him like stink. His heart almost breaks over some nuns he meets because they have cheap suitcases. Lord have mercy. So he sees this family, and the child is singing and humming. If a body catch a body, coming through the rye. Holden watches and says, it made me feel better. It made me feel not so depressed anymore. He doesn't explain why that song catches his attention, but he will later, so just hang on to it for now. This is just about halfway through the story and sets things up nicely for how the book will come to its final crisis and then untangle its knots, so to speak. Remember, that's what denouement means. A few pages after this, Holden walks through Central Park toward the Museum of Natural History. He remembers taking field trips there as a kid, and the memory makes him happy. I remember that after we looked at all the Indian stuff, usually we went to see some movie in this big auditorium. They were always showing Columbus discovering America, having one hell of a time getting old Ferdinand and Isabella to lend him the dough to buy ships with. He remembers the auditorium had a nice smell like rain. I loved that damn museum, he says. He describes in great detail the dioramas of Indians making fires and Eskimo ice fishing, deer drinking and birds flying. The best thing in that museum was that everything stayed right where it was. Nobody'd move. You'd go there 100,000 times and that Eskimo would still be there, just finished catching those two fish. Nobody'd be different. The only thing that would be different is you. This makes him think about his little sister Phoebe and how she, too, would be a very different person every time she visited the museum. Certain things should stay the way they are. You ought to be able to stick them in one of those big glass cases and just leave them alone. I know that's impossible, but it's too bad anyway. This is heartbreakingly sad, and knowing he lost his brother so young to leukemia, it's no wonder. It is becoming increasingly clear that Holden worships childhood because his brother lost his. Holden goes on a disaster date with a girl named Sally Hayes, who he sort of hates and also thinks is quite attractive, especially in her ice skating dress. Towards the end of the date, he asks her if she likes school, and she says it's boring, normal answer. And he says, I mean, do you hate it? She hedges. Well, I hate it, he says. But it isn't just that, it's everything. I hate living in New York and all. He then goes on to list everything he hates about New York and the boys' schools he attended and so on. He has clearly lost her, but he can't help himself. He finally admits his own misanthropy. I don't get hardly anything out of anything. I'm in bad shape. I'm in lousy shape. This truly heart-rending cry for help surely passed me by almost every time I read Catcher in the past. But now, as a mother and a teacher who has seen how kids can cry for help in myriad ways, I just ache for this kid. He is in serious trouble. Closing in on the final scenes of Holden's journey through New York, he makes his way through the pitch dark of Central Park, finding the lagoon. It is partly frozen and he does not see a single duck. He becomes cold enough to worry about frostbite or worse, so he decides to sneak into his own apartment and see his sister. His love for innocence and youth is made most apparent as he talks with Phoebe. It is a lovely, endearing scene. Everything she does, quote, kills him. But she is on to him. She says, you don't like anything. You don't like a million things. You don't. He protests, and she demands that he name something he truly likes. As he is thinking, he remembers a terrible story. He recalls that a boy he knew at an old school was so bullied by classmates one night that he threw himself out a window to his death. Finally, he says to Phoebe, I like Allie. And she shoots back, Allie's dead. You always say that. So he tells her how much he likes it right now, just sitting with her. She doesn't get it. That isn't anything, really. Then she asks him what he wants to be, like a lawyer or a scientist. He, of course, shoots down all the traditional options. Then he says, you know what I'd like to be? I mean, if I had my goddamn choice. You know that song, If a Body Catch a Body, Come and Throw the Rye? I keep picturing all these little kids playing some game in this big field of rye and all. Thousands of little kids and nobody's around. Nobody big, I mean, except me. And I'm standing on the edge of some crazy cliff. What I have to do... I have to catch everybody if they start to go over the cliff. I'll just be the catcher in the rye and all. I know it's crazy. Phoebe corrects him and says, it's meet, not catch. If a body, meet a body. This mistake is interesting because he also seems to have missed the sexual undertones of the song. If a body kiss a body, Jenny's seldom dry. It's sweet that he misses it, and it reveals some of his own stubborn innocence, despite his potty mouth and his drinking and smoking. But back to Holden's desire to save the little children. For all that he hates everything, he is in love with everything. He is so in love with the young, beautiful world that he wants to save it from anything bad that might mess it up. So this leads immediately into a decision to ring up an old teacher, Mr. Antolini, who we find out is the teacher who arrived at the scene of the kid's suicide at the old school. Holden admired him especially because of his tender care in the face of that awful tragedy. He wrapped the boy in his own coat and carried him to the infirmary. I suppose at this point, Holden is desperate for a mentor and desperate for an adult he can depend on, an adult that will prove that growing up is not inevitably a corruption. Mr. Antolini is drinking a highball when Holden arrives and continues to do so throughout a pretty deep and ranging conversation. Antolini does his teacherly best to explain to Holden why at some point he will have to apply himself and get his education. And it resonates somewhat with Holden, more than what most adults say to him. Finally, Holden lets out a huge yawn, and his old teacher prepares a bed for him on the sofa. Good night, handsome, he says. Then, quote, something happened. I don't even like to talk about it. Holden wakes to Mr. Antolini patting him on the head. Is this a sexual overture? It is left deliberately unclear, but Holden is not at all unclear about what he thinks about it. He jumps about 50 feet in the air and asks what he is doing and then rushes to leave. Of course, Antolini feigns shock and denies anything has happened. As Holden leaves, he thinks, I know more damn perverts at school and all than anybody you ever met, and they're always being perverty when I'm around. He says perverty stuff has happened to him about 20 times since he was a kid. Sadly, I've sat through enough predator awareness training videos to know this may in fact be true. Holden is a loner, a misfit, a sensitive, depressed, searching young man, a perfect target. But ugh, this is exactly not what Holden needs right now, another adult letting him down. He leaves the apartment more depressed than I have ever been in my whole life. He is walking New York in the dark in the days before Christmas, and he says all of a sudden, something very spooky started happening. Each time I came to the end of the block and stepped off the goddamn curb, I had this feeling that I'd never get to the other side of the street. So he would make believe he was talking to his dead brother, Allie. Allie, don't let me disappear. Allie, don't let me disappear. Please, Allie. And that's when I'd reach the other side, and then I'd thank him. This crisis spurs him to decide to run away. He concocts a whole fantasy that ends with a cabin in the woods and a beautiful deaf-mute wife. I want to scream misogyny, but I think it's more about his need to control things and not be judged. If they had children, they would hide them. As he prepares to leave, he writes Phoebe a note that he drops off at her school, asking her to meet him at the Met to say goodbye. At the school, he sees someone has written, "Fuck you," on a wall. It drove me damn near crazy, he says. I thought about how Phoebe and all those little kids would see it. I kept wanting to kill whoever had written it. I figured that it was some perverty bum that had sneaked in the school late at night. I kept picturing myself catching him at it and how I'd smash his head on the stone steps until he was good and goddamn dead and bloody. But I knew, too, that I wouldn't have the guts to do it. That made me even more depressed. He rubs the words off the wall, but then he sees another fuck you on another wall of the school. At the Met, he finds his way to the Egyptian exhibits and walks into a tomb. Is this the abyss on the hero's journey? Like when Odysseus visits the underworld? Maybe. I sort of liked it, in a way. It was so nice and peaceful. Then what does he see? Another fuck you written on a wall. That's the trouble, he says. You can't find a place that's nice and peaceful because there isn't any. So you probably don't need my help here, but clearly this is Holden's crisis. He is longing for innocence, and he is terrified of the evil in this world that threatens to steal it away. Antolini has rattled him, and he wants to protect Phoebe and everyone else her age from all the perverty stuff swirling around them, creeping ever closer with every fuck you written in a stairwell. Even death itself, the Egyptian tomb, is tainted with this perverty crap. When he walks outside, he sees Phoebe coming to meet him, in his hunting hat, which he had given her, and carrying a large suitcase. I'm coming with you, she says. No, you're not, he says. This goes back and forth until she is crying and chucking his hat in his face. Desperate, Holden says, okay, how about I let you skip the rest of the school day and we take a walk, maybe go to the zoo? She reluctantly agrees. They pass by the carousel in Central Park, and he asks if she wants to take a ride. I'm too big, she says. He insists, and she relents. I watched her go around and around. The carousel was playing, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and all the kids kept trying to grab for the gold ring, and so was old Phoebe, and I was sort of afraid she'd fall off the goddamn horse, but I didn't say anything or do anything. And here's where Salinger is at his best, showing, not telling. He has evolved enough to know that he cannot put her in a glass diorama and freeze her forever. He will have to let her grow up. To calm her down, Holden tells Phoebe he is not running away after all. She is happy and agrees to keep riding the carousel. But first, she pulls the red hunting hat out of Holden's own coat and plops it on his head. You can wear it a while, she says. She ran and bought her ticket and got back on the goddamn carousel just in time. Then she walked all the way around it till she got her own horse back. Then it began to rain, quote, buckets. Holden gets pretty soaked, but the, quote, hunting hat really gave me quite a lot of protection. I felt so damn happy all of a sudden, the way Phoebe kept going around and around. What does that hat symbolize? I would say it's Holden's way of protecting himself from the world and a way to stop himself from disappearing. And the ducks, the Museum of Natural History, he likes things to stay the same, to be frozen in time. It all goes back to his brother, who in death remains forever frozen in childhood. Allie's catcher's mitt, covered in poetry, is a testament to the tender, poetic hearts of all the Caulfield children. Even Phoebe writes stories in her marbled composition notebooks, all of them featuring a girl detective. And of course, a catcher's mitt, once belonging to a kid who played outfield and then died. Well, you can now put together why Holden wants to be a catcher in the rye. And while he may not be able to save everyone, he saves Phoebe by protecting her from his own self-destructive whim of running away, but also by letting her grab for the gold ring and not worrying about her falling off her horse, by letting her go just a little. Last spring, I took the senior yearbook girls, you remember, the haters, to New York on a field trip to attend a conference at Columbia. I knew Caroline was a diehard catcher fan, which kind of makes sense, right? She collects out-of-print editions of the book and has read it multiple times. The field trip was small, so we were not on a large tour or anything, and we had some freedom to decide how to spend our days. I mentioned offhand that they might like to see the carousel that is the setting for the final scene of The Catcher in the Rye. Caroline's eyes widened and moistened at the same time. It's real, she said, almost trembling. Oh yes, I said, and so is the lagoon with the ducks. When we met in the lobby of our hotel to walk to Central Park, Caroline was wearing a red hunting hat, just like Holden's. We walked into the park from the west side and made our way to the lagoon. Caroline sat weeping on a boulder as a pair of ducks glided by. At the carousel, the girls, all of them 18 and on their way to college, waited excitedly for me to buy their tickets. It was early, and they were the only riders. They carefully chose horses with the glee of five-year-olds. The music began, and slowly they began to move. Around and around they went, their faces breaking into wondrous, happy grins. It was a most unphony moment. And that's it. Sleep tight, you morons. If you enjoyed this episode of Cocktail Party Takeaways, please show your love. 5-star ratings, reviews, and subscribers help the podcast make it into best of lists. To stay up to date on future episodes, follow me on Twitter at AnneRochelle67. That's AnneRochelle67. My website, AnneRochelle.com, is where you can go for more information about me or about the podcast. That's Anne with an E, Rochelle without. This episode of Cocktail Party Takeaways was recorded by David Silverman and produced by Gus Kenigsmark. Original music by Gus Kenigsmark. Cover art by Stuart Key. Cheers, and let's all read more.